Welcome to the deep dive. Let's jump right into the source material you've shared with us today, this really raw, unfiltered excerpt. It's titled Tales of a Sea Celebrity Blood in My Stool.
Yeah, quite a title.
It drops us right into one specific, pretty memorable night in Bend, Oregon.
And it certainly is memorable. So our mission here really is to take this incredibly vivid personal account, unpack the narrative you've brought us, and really dig into what it tells us about the author's perspective.
Especially on those themes like freedom, right? Living life on his own terms.
Exactly. And how those play out in the, well, the messy reality of a night like this one. We want to pull out the key insights and maybe those aha moments from this really unapologetic account.
Right. Think of this deep dive as helping you navigate this story. We'll look at the settings he describes, the characters he runs into, the sequence of events.
But always asking why. You know,
yeah.
Why do these details matter in the context of his larger point about life post-divorce being off the lease, as he puts it?
Okay, so let's start where he does. Bend, Oregon. He's post-divorce.
And he immediately frames this whole period as being off the leash. He even calls it the goddamn high point of life on his own terms.
Which is interesting. That kind of freedom he describes, it isn't quiet reflection, is it?
Not at all. It's this raw, almost like defiant liberty. And it seems tied to specific places.
Like his church, as he calls it, this dive bar, Corey's.
Yeah, and the description tells you so much, doesn't it? Tired, honest grit.
He talks about the guys there, their clothes kind of stained with oil and regret.
It's a specific kind of maybe authenticity he's seeking, or maybe reflecting. It's definitely the opposite of polished.
And the drinks match that vibe, right? Rainier tall boys.
Real working man's beer, he calls them. And gut rot whiskey. There's really no pretense there.
It feels like this is where he feels grounded, weirdly, in this newfound freedom.
Yeah, it's a paradox. Yeah. And it's in this setting he first spots this character. The goddamn handsome slacker type.
Right. And the author's judgment is, well, pretty sharp, says the guys at the absolute bottom of life's pit.
Just chasing 20-year-olds, basically. It's a quick observation, but it paints a picture of the ecosystem he's in, and maybe hints at something he's watching out for or consciously avoiding.
So, moving the night along, he's not actually alone this evening. He's with Kelly.
His on-off girlfriend for the night.
Yeah.
And his description of her is blunt. Butter butt, I think.
Yeah, but then he immediately follows it with surprisingly advanced, saying she's teaching him new tricks.
Which, even though it's brief, gives you a glimpse into their relationship, doesn't it, in this off-the-leash time. Mm. It sounds casual, maybe transactional.
Maybe even experimental. Mm. But Kelly brings along some company.
And this is where the dynamic gets interesting. Her cousin tags along.
Oh, yeah. And the author really doesn't hold back describing her. Vegan type, not a looker.
And carrying this, like, really palpable, judgmental, stick-up-her-ass look, he actually says he feels the judgment radiating off her.
So she immediately becomes this kind of foil, right? Representing the conventional world he seems to be kicking against.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She's the scrutiny he's determined to ignore, or maybe even provoke. And then Kelly suggests they change venues.
To the Silver Moon Brewery.
Right. And his description, a goddamn madhouse.
Ooh.
Packed. So it's a real shift from that grimy feel of Corey's to something much more public and chaotic.
And it's there. At the brewery bar, we get another one of these unexpected encounters. It kind of highlights his place in this local scene.
The bartender. He notes she recognizes him right away.
Oh, wow. Look what the cat dragged in. Hi, James.
So not a random interaction then.
No, we find out they have a history. A quick, messy tumble out behind my restaurant a few months back, followed by mutual ghosting.
Right. But despite that, maybe because of that, the outcome is kind of telling.
It really is. She immediately gets him drinks. Three big cold beers slid across the bar, no charge.
And he frames it as a little dividend from a past investment, just a casual thanks, love. It shows his comfort level, maybe.
Yeah.
His established presence. Even that sort of minor celebrity status he has in certain parts of Bend, he navigates these places with a certain social currency, it seems.
Definitely leveraging past encounters. So drinks in hand, he then spots that handsome slacker guy again, the one from Corey's.
Who's now kind of drift in the brewery crowd.
And this is where the author gets strategic, aimed squarely at simplifying his own night.
He sees the cousin, who's clearly, you know, cramping his style, and he sees the slacker.
The solution. He nudges Kelly. Hey, why don't you introduce your friend to my friend?
And apparently it worked like a charm. The flacker and the cousin just wander off together.
But for the author, this isn't about playing matchmaker, is it?
Not at all. He calls it a small, perfect victory. Why? Because he doesn't have to carry the damn conversation for three people anymore. It's purely tactical, clearing the way for his own enjoyment.
Which brings us to the music. He seems really into it.
Yeah, he describes the band as awesome, captures this heavy Johnny Cash vibe, but with a chugging train track beat like Social Distortion.
He says he's into it, really into it, dancing with Kelly, beer buzz going. Life feels pretty damn good in that moment.
He's totally immersed, you know, the bar, the music, the beer, the company. It's all part of that high point he talked about.
And during a band break, feeling good, king of the castle, he says.
Fueled by six beers, yeah.
He decides to buy a round for the whole band, like a gesture of appreciation.
Maybe solidifying his place in this scene he's enjoying so much, but then the bartender steps in again.
Right. He offers to buy the round, and she just smiles. It's on me tonight, James.
Another past connection paying off.
Yeah.
Doubling down on the freebies. So he takes two bottles up to the stage.
And up there, another moment of recognition happens.
He hands over the beers, and a band member spots his jacket, Social Distortion jacket. Another one of those cultural signifiers.
Awesome jacket, Social D, the guy says.
And then, hey, you're James, aren't you?
He confirms, yeah. And the musician says he's been to the author's restaurant, likes it. It's all good, man.
And the author frames this exchange kind of cynically as a little moment of bullshit male bonding over cheap beer and loud music.
But then right after that cynicism, he admits the whole goddamn world felt all right in that moment.
Exactly. That little nod from the band, that shared appreciation for the music, the subculture, it reinforces his sense of belonging, right? Validation within the church he's chosen. It's such a contrast to the judgment he feels from the cousin.
Okay, so the night wears on, it's getting hot, crowded.
Yeah, Kelly, the cousin, and the slacker step outside into the alley for some air, and the author follows them.
And this is where the narrative takes a sharp turn, plunges us into the most audacious part of the night.
He describes seeing a woman emerge from the dim alley light.
Right.
Some kind of dream, he says.
His description of her is quick, short little thing, mini skirt, but it's her walk he focuses on.
Oh, yeah. He really fixates on it. Her toe-to-toe stride in a pair of stilettos that could kill a man. A walk that started a drool factor deep in your gut. A goddamn swagger.
It's not just noticing someone attractive. It's this immediate, like, visceral reaction to this image of confidence, maybe even danger.
And his response is just instantaneous, decisive, really embodying that off-the-leash thing.
Without breaking eye contact with her, he turns to Kelly. Curt dismissal. Gotta go talk to somebody real quick. I'll meet you guys back inside.
And he's aware of how this looks, right? He guesses the cousin's thinking, where the fuck is this asshole going?
Yeah.
Versus Kelly's maybe more naive. Oh, he knows a lot of people.
He makes a beeline for this woman. Little Lucy, he calls her. Grabs her hand, pulls her into the shadows next to a car.
The conversation's minimal.
Huh?
How you doing? What you up to? And then it escalates really quickly to embracing, exchanging fluids.
He's brutally honest about it. Quick and dirty, in and out.
About 15 minutes of pure, unapologetic chaos. Definitely not a tantric spiritual union.
But the key thing is how he felt during it. Simply enjoying my goddamn life.
That's the raw core of his freedom in that moment, isn't it? Pursuing that immediate gratification. No hesitation, no apparent regret.
And the aftermath is just as stark. They pull themselves together like a couple of soldiers after a skirmish, walk back their separate ways.
No lingering connection described, just the pursuit and its abrupt end.
He walks back towards Kelly and the cousin, knowing it's obvious what just went down.
Yeah, he imagines he still smells the other woman all over me, maybe even has a goddamn wet spot. It's not shame, though. It's almost like a public declaration.
And the cousin's reaction confirms it. Her face is a mask of pure, sour judgment. She knew exactly what had happened.
So this is that collision, right?
Yeah.
His radical freedom smacking right into conventional morality, personified by her disgust.
But then, almost immediately, he gets public validation from the bar community as he walked back inside.
The band stops, mid-song. Lead singer leans into the mic, points right at him. And there he is, back from his adventures.
And the whole bar just laughs. The author acknowledges, yeah, it was obvious I was just outside getting my wick dipped. No hiding it.
He's not trying to hide it. It seems like his world, this specific world, actually celebrates this kind of behavior.
And then the bass player steps forward. Big dude. Huge instrument he calls a goddamn coffin with strings.
And he starts playing that iconic Johnny Cash intro. Dum, dum, dum. Ring of fire.
But he doesn't just play it. He lays the massive bass down.
And proceeds to dry hump the damn thing right there on the spot.
Oh, wow. The author calls it primal. Insane.
The music gets louder, faster. The whole place becomes pure chaos. A spectacular show.
And for the author, this completely bizarre performance, this public chaos, it feels directed right at him.
This is all for me, he thinks. Goddamn coronation. And he links it directly back to buying the band those beers earlier.
It's their final song. A perfect, filthy end to a perfect, filthy night, he calls it. This moment just sums up the acceptance, even the, like, adulation he finds in this community. Total contrast to the cousin's judgment.
So the night's finally winding down. He goes to settle his tab.
And the bartender confirms the theme of the night. You don't owe a thing tonight, James.
Freebies and connections all the way. But, she adds the kicker, but I'd like to see you at your restaurant on Tuesday.
So the final score, free drinks all night, and a date for Tuesday.
It's a tangible benefit, isn't it, of his unapologetic presence in this specific Ben scene.
Meanwhile, what happened to the slacker and the vegan cousin?
Yeah, that potential setup. Went up in smoke, he says. He figures the cousin saw the slacker as part of my whole grimy operation, especially after witnessing the alley thing, and just wanted out.
And the author's take?
He admits he ruined that for him, but dismisses it. Small price to pay for my own entertainment.
Wow. That really reinforces his whole on-his-own-terms freedom thing. His desires come first, even if it messes things up for others.
Definitely. So the final act is the walk back to the car.
And the cousin, predictably, unloads on him. Makes accusations.
Yeah, things like having sex with a midget in stilettos, which he corrects flirting too much with the bartender, probably setting up that date.
And his response is classic. All false accusations, of course. Well, mostly.
That mostly is just perfect raw honesty from him, isn't it?
And interestingly, Kelly actually steps in to defend him. Tells her cousin she's being rude, overblowing the whole damn thing.
Even after seeing what happened in the alley, her reaction is more protective than judgmental. It's complex.
And despite everything, Kelly still takes him home. He stays the whole weekend, apparently. Cousin gets the couch.
It's a strange resolution. Really highlights the maybe dysfunction, maybe just the different rules of these relationships in his off-the-leash period.
And there's one final defiant act described in the source. Back at Kelly's place.
He makes sure the sounds for the bedroom are loud enough, specifically to irritate the self-righteous bitches of the world.
Which is clearly aimed right back at the cousin's judgment. It's his ultimate rebellion against that scrutiny.
And this whole night, this goddamn circus, he makes it clear it wasn't just a one-off. It was just one day out of 1,000 during his bachelor days in Bend, Oregon.
Which connects directly back to that about the author summary you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. That summary presents him as this unfiltered voice using raw honesty, that whiskey-stained truth, to talk about his personal scars and fuck-ups, exploring themes like freedom, confinement, shedding past identities.
And this night is just a perfect, maybe extreme example of all that, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's the freedom of being off the leash, the unapologetic honesty in how he acts and tells the story, and that active defiance against the judgment represented by the cousin. He's shedding one identity and embracing something raw and self-defined.
So for you, the listener, why is this account so compelling? I think it's because it offers such a raw, unvarnished look at a very specific kind of personal freedom and defiance. It really challenges conventional norms.
It's a vivid, messy snapshot, and crucially is presented without any apology whatsoever.
We've taken a deep dive into one really chaotic, memorable night, all from the perspective laid out in your source material.
Yeah, it's a story just packed with unexpected encounters, actions driven by this unapologetic impulse.
And offering a unique, almost defiant view on finding one's own definition of a high point, even in the middle of life's messiness.
It definitely leaves you with a lot to think about. Judgment, personal freedom, what people choose to embrace or maybe hide about their own adventures.
So here's a final thought for you to mull over from this account. In a world where so much of what we share about ourselves is, you know, carefully polished, curated for everyone else, what's the value, or maybe what's the cost, of choosing instead to embrace and share the ugly, unvarnished truth of our own experiences?